House, please come to order. Our chaplain for today in the House is Pastor Bo Moline of the Bethel Assembly of God Church. The House, please rise for prayer.
Lord God, this day help us to live together in a spirit of unity, work for the good of mankind, and believe for the best that you have to offer. Amen.
Under the uniform rules of the Alaska Legislature, President of the Senate presides over joint sessions. My pleasure this time to turn the gavel over to President of the Senate, John Rader.
The joint session will come to order. Senator Coletta.
Mr. President, I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call vote for the Senate be waived and all senators be listed as present.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, it's ordered. Representative Miller.
Mr. President, I'll ask unanimous consent that the roll call of the House be waived, that all representatives be shown as present.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, it's ordered. We'll appoint Senator Bill Ray and Representative Joe Hayes to escort Senator Stevens to the podium. The joint session will stand in at ease. Joint session will come back to order. While we have a moment or two, if we might, it's my pleasure to introduce to the joint session Ann Stevens. Joint session will come back to order.
Ladies and gentlemen, the senior senator from the state of Alaska, the Honorable Ted Stevens.
Senator, it is with great pleasure that we welcome you back to these chambers. I noticed the introductory line of your speech was that this was your 10th report to the Alaska State Legislature. We hope that that there will be three times that many more. We welcome you here.
Thank you very much. Good to see you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you. I left my speech over there. I thought maybe you might read it for me. Thank you very much. John, it's good to be back, and it's nice to be back with all of you. I see time has not passed so fast that there are not many familiar faces still out there. Brings back great memories. This is my 10th report to the state legislature, and I don't know if you know it. As I pointed out last time I was here, we are the only state, I think, that has this procedure whereby we come, if you invite us, and give you our opinion of the state-federal relationships and then answer your questions. This year, Congress, as you know, is mandated to act on the Deke II question. I think this is the most important Alaskan issue since statehood. And it's appropriate on this occasion, I think, to try and give you a full accounting, to provide perspective on how far we have come, focus on where I think we must go and what we must do to conserve, consolidate, and capitalize on our past gains. We confront a really formidable challenge in the D2 issue. If we're going to be able to resolve that D2 question in the best interest of Alaska and all Americans, I think we must understand the profound changes that have taken place, not only here, but in the composition of Congress and the prevailing attitude of the American people towards Alaska. We've made great progress since statehood. I'm sure you realize that. We've grown in population and per capita income. We're just beginning to tap the potential of our petroleum and mineral resources. We together have initiated programs necessary to prosper from and replenish our renewable resources, and we've steadily extended both the quantity and quality of Alaska's public services. All of this has been accomplished, I think, through teamwork between Alaska state government and those of us who are federal representatives for Alaska in Washington. Your innovative programs, your responsible legislation, and steadfast cooperation, and I mean that, have been integral to our success in achieving federal legislation and funding to advance Alaska's interests. The list of the accomplishments are long. We've had the 200-mile limit and its benefits, Coast Guard and its improved surveillance system. We've got increased federal funding for hatcheries, fishways, for fisheries research. I think one of the great new potentials of Alaska is the potential for construction of new vessels capable of multi-season harvesting of our fisheries resources. You know about the Native Land Claims Act, as we all do, and I don't know that you know that over the last 3 years, Alaska's Native people have received $525 million in federal aid to improve virtually every aspect of community life, housing, health, education, employment opportunities. We've had a new airport program, the Airport Aid Development Aid Program, which we call ADAP, has resulted in some additional $58 million in federal funds to improve and expand our airport facilities. This year alone, we'll receive $28 million for construction and improvements, plus $64.6 million to operate our airports. It might interest you to know that we are second in the nation in terms of aid from the ADAP program. Over $94 million has now been allocated to hydroelectric programs in our state, plus harbor and navigational improvements. And we've now got $33 million requested this year for the Chena River Lakes construction program. I think, and it's spelled out more fully in the printed statement that we've released here, some of these things that I think are milestones and achievements as far as Alaska is concerned in Washington. But it means to me that our interests have not been neglected by Congress. To the contrary, despite our small numbers in Washington, our voices have been heard and our needs have been recognized. And while we've suffered reverses, most notably the unfair limit on subsistence taking of the bowhead whale, Washington's responses to most of our needs have been notable. However, it is the very fact that we've won so many battles that places us in the danger of losing the next war. Having covered the positive side, let me with equal candor discuss the liability side of our ledger, which may negatively affect the outcome of the D2 controversy. First, the composition of the Congress has almost totally changed over the last two decades. Just think of this. Of the 96 senators who in 1958 voted on the question of Alaska statehood, only 14 remain there now. Only 14 who remember the commitments that were made at that time. Two of those 14 will retire this year. This means that when we start the next Congress in January of 1979, no more than 12% of the Senate will have any sense of the original commitment made to this state when we became a state. The situation on the House side is identical. Only 45 out of the 435 representatives remain from 1958, and at least 10 of them have already announced their retirement. So barely 10% of the House in the next Congress will have any concept of the terms of our statehood. And the Carter administration, and I don't say this politically, the Carter administration is new. It's unfamiliar with the ways of Washington and the Congress, and much less unfamiliar with Alaska. The four previous presidents had been in Congress, and all had supported Alaska's admission into the Union. Our president now does not have that background. In fairness, let me note President Carter and the key members of his administration have always been accessible to me, not just on national issues, but on those of particular concern to Alaska. But clearly, our real liability is the lack of knowledge and a historic commitment among the members of Congress and the administration to statehood. Second, we face a well-organized, well-financed, extreme environmental lobby, which has already launched a sophisticated public relations campaign to influence Congress. A recent example was a full-page ad that was placed in the Washington Post and several other national newspapers, calling themselves Americans for Alaska Committee. Now, I don't know if you saw that, but I just tore one out and brought it with me. I'm sure you must have seen it. I hope that you'll notice some of these names, because I find them very interesting. That was carried in national newspapers and has 50 of the most prestigious citizens of the United States that you could find. Their names are easily recognizable as members of Congress. They represent various respected segments of the national economy and society. The list included Vernon Jordan of the National Urban League, Nancy Kissinger, who was the wife of our former Secretary of State, Lawrence Rockefeller, Leonard Firestone, representing high finance and big business, General Matthew Ridgway, and Admiral Elmo Zumwalt from the military. This highly privileged group may consider themselves Americans for Alaska, but they don't represent the average American. They don't represent Alaskans for Alaska or Alaskans for America either. Yet, this is an example of the pressure we face from the South 48 self-proclaimed experts on Alaskan ecology as Congress begins the D2 deliberations. And I think that's an important fact to keep in mind. We face really formidable opposition. Third and most disturbing is an increasing animosity towards Alaskans as Arabs of the North, who hold vital resources hostage for handouts from the federal government and the financial community. Now, regardless of the facts, the prevailing attitude outside is that for years, first as a territory and then as a fledgling state, the U.S. taxpayer took care of Alaska, and now the roles are reversed. They believe Alaska is not repaying its debt. These are principal liabilities which we must overcome, and while each largely involves image rather than substance, systematic, specific action is imperative to correct the situation. And let me submit to you some suggestions along that line. I think we must educate Congress about Alaska prior to the D2 votes. And the best way I know to accomplish this mission is to bring as many members of Congress, senators and representatives, to Alaska. Seeing is believing. Once they've experienced Alaska, they will become our advocates, I believe. Over the past years, I've brought several small Senate delegations to Alaska. The schedules combined business and recreation, so we're able to expose them to Alaska's outdoor life. Instances have arisen where the voices of these men saying, "Yes, that's right, I've been there," have been the deciding factor in swinging a vote our way. It has happened, and I think it can happen again now at a time when we most need it. Right now, 90% of the Congress has no direct knowledge of Alaska. It's only our word versus that of the powerful nationwide environmental groups. The best investment the state can make, I think, is to sponsor congressional fact-finding trips to Alaska. And we must also encourage Alaska citizens to mount a public relations campaign to counter that of the extreme environmental lobby. We must tell and sell the true story about Alaska's D2 proposal. We're not proposing to desecrate the environment. No other state has dedicated so much of its land to wilderness. No other citizens are so personally committed to environmental protection. Our proposal does protect Alaska's future options. It permits environmentally sound use of those resources essential to the national economy and the national security, and allocates funds from any such development to purchase park and wilderness areas in the lower 48, which will be accessible to the average American family who cannot afford to visit Alaska. Ours is a reasonable and responsible, safe and sensible proposal, in my opinion. The key to it is to explain it with the same sophisticated public relations techniques that are being employed by the opposition. I feel confident that if lower 48 citizens fully understand our position, they will bring constituent pressure on their representatives to support our D2 proposal. And while it's not really within my prerogative to comment too much on it, let me tell you that I'm more and more convinced that the state must have an economic policy which emphasizes stability and fairness. We have many resources to supply the nation, and those resources can be supplied in a way which benefits Alaska as well. A responsible, stable, regulatory and tax system will permit industry to make long-term plans and will encourage them to join us in building a diversified economy. I feel we must make it clear that we intend to use our natural gas in Alaska before the design of the Alcan line is completed. Our royalty gas should serve as the foundation for a full, value-added industrial development program. We can diversify Alaska's economy, create permanent jobs and dependable revenues without increasing state resource taxes or charges. A declared added value economic development policy will document Alaska's intention to profit from our resources through earned effort in state rather than by exploitation through export out of state. And we have to do all we can do to see that the gas line is built. Our natural gas at Prudhoe Bay isn't worth much to us until the line is completed, the gas is flowing, and we can start collecting gas-related revenues. One thing we could do to help is to get involved in the financing of the gas line. Northwest and its financial advisors recently outlined to me a proposal in which they recommend the state participate through commitment of revenues the state will receive from royalties and taxes on the gas itself. Although I've not seen the details, this does appear to be a concept worth exploring. The final decision on state participation is obviously one for the governor and you and the legislature to make. This is necessarily so because of other important issues that have to be resolved, including takeoffs for the gas and conditions for the use of state lands. But as one of your representatives in Washington, my concern is ensuring that we do not overcommit oil and general fund revenues, which we have indicated are available to guarantee other projects, such as the Susitna dams and the permanent fund. We need to reorganize and reserve funds to offset decreased federal spending, too, in certain areas. Once Alaska's native claims are fully settled and pipeline revenues provide a steady source of income, the federal government will inevitably reduce its level of participation in our economy, particularly in human service areas where population and need, and I put that in quotes, need are factored into the equation of federal participation. By initiating policies now to promote a diversified value-added economy and not overcommitting projected future revenues, we could demonstrate the stability, responsibility, and maturity to attract that private capital that we need. And I think that those steps would carry our message as well to the Congress and the American people that Alaska has come of age, that we've demonstrated our confidence to be fair, to be full, responsible partners in managing our own future as part of the Union. Now, I've left out of my comments discussion of national issues and foreign policy. I hope that you, if you have any questions, you'll ask them of me. Over the past year, really the past 3 months, Ann and I have visited Panama, India, the Middle East, and several NATO nations. Some people call them junkets, and I guess they are. But they're important to us to learn about the rest of the world as we try to represent Alaska and Washington. You and I, we share together in the year ahead some tremendous challenges and also some great responsibility. For the consequences of our actions will not only affect Alaska's, but America's future. We know Alaska is literally Alaska's last frontier and the last bastion of freedom. Our wilderness affords the last place where a human can exercise his most fundamental right to be left alone, to escape civilization, and literally to be free. Those who would lock up Alaska would lock up the human spirit. In his Portrait of Alaska, now the number one nonfiction bestseller in America, coming into the country, John McPhee wrote of this driving force to be free and the tragic implications of federal legislation and regulations on the Alaska lifestyle. And this is a quote from his book, which I hope all of you have read. It is one of the ironies of Alaska that in the midst of this tremendous wilderness, people consider themselves fortunate to have anywhere at all a 50 by 100 foot lot they can call their own. What the law now calls for is the removal of the last place in the United States where the pioneer impulse can leap from confinement. It is in the character of the impulse to leap anyway. The momentum is too great to be interrupted by an act of Congress. I fully believe that, and I fully believe that we're working not on just legislation to draw lines on a map, but I think we're really working on legislation that has a great deal to do with the future lifestyle of Alaska and the whole country. I hope that you will dedicate your energy in the year ahead to help us protect this last bastion of freedom from what I consider to be a very ill-considered act of Congress. And we should be able to work together to preserve that pioneer impulse so that Alaska's wilderness may continue to provide a habitat for all species, including the human spirit. Thank you. I hope you have some questions of me. I'd be glad to answer them.
Are there any questions? The senator prefers that we go through the chair. Representative Urien.
Well, I hope that you will consider not one trip, but two. I'm very serious. I think that you should make plans now and that we should have some coordination now so that when the bill gets to the floor of the House, you, hopefully as many as can come, and I would prefer to see it the way you suggest, that you all come if you can, join with members of the business and labor community and come back and take the time to visit with some of those 435 people. There are some risks involved in it, and let me tell you, I've been through this now three times. We did it at statehood, we did it with a pipeline, and we did it with a land claims act. But I think this is a tougher battle than any one of those three. And I think the risk is that we may not speak with one voice. I think there has to be some awareness of the problems of dealing with that House and the fact that whether you're a Democrat or Republican, there's only one man there that votes for us now. And same thing on our side, there are two of us. And we have to deal with people and with issues, and what to you might be an acceptable amendment would not be acceptable to us because we know that someone else has an interest in the provision that you're willing to forget about. And we've talked and, you know, we've had working relationships for years now, literally, on this bill. But I do think that you ought to come And I think you ought to come on the basis of when Don says it's necessary in the House and when Mike and I feel it's necessary in the Senate. And there ought to be a charter, as there was at the time of the oil pipeline, and that you ought to come and we ought to have groups of a legislator and a labor person, a leader, and a business leader, and someone, if possible, from the executive branch, and you ought to go in and visit with these members of Congress and be prepared to tell them of our commitment. As I said, I really believe we have a firm commitment to the environment, and that it's not necessary to draw lines on a map to confirm that commitment. But basically, it must be done. Now, and it will happen. It's sort of, we're in a war. You know, I remember reading about people in World War II that were senators and congressmen that went off and volunteered to serve. And everyone wondered, you know, what's wrong with those guys? They were sent to Washington to represent their states. But when you're involved in a war, you've got to have the commitment to win it. And we really need your help. And Steve knows this, and the others have come back there. This is not a partisan issue. This is the future of the state we're talking about. And I don't care, even if you're an extreme Alaska environmentalist, you still ought to be with us there talking about what Alaskans feel about the environment. Because so many people are telling them, well, we don't even think about it. We're just here to rape and rip, which is not true. And I do believe that we need to demonstrate the commitment. We need some of those people that McPhee talked about in his book. Just think of that, and then I'll stop my answer to your question because there's bound to be other questions. McPhee's book's the number one bestseller in the country because you can't read it without being captured by the fact that there's a new group of mountain men, there's a new group of people who are seeking freedom in this state. Well, that's got to be hitting the American conscience, that we can't be so bad or all these people wouldn't be wanting to come up here and enjoy what we enjoy about the state, and that's the freedom of it. Now, if we can carry that through to the members of Congress and ask them to listen to us and give us time, just give us time to review these areas, then I think maybe all of us could be satisfied with the end product. Now, I don't know whether it'll work. It worked three times before, and I say, you know, if the lady tells you that you should stay here, well, I just tell her, as far as I'm concerned, the war's in Washington. This year. It really is.
Representative Bradley, were you seeking the floor, sir?
Yes, my question.
Senator Ray.
Senator Stevens, you spoke more or less in generalities here, and you mentioned shadows, et cetera, and some of the problems that we have. And from experience, I think that you can speak a little straighter than that, at least I hope you can. I would ask you, what, in your estimation, is Alaska's biggest problem on the D2 proposition that exists now in Washington?
Well, Senator Ray, Bill, I guess, you know, if you put it that way, I've got to answer it that way. The biggest problem is we're not unified. The biggest problem is that despite the fact that I thought we were together, and I don't say we're that far apart, Senator Gravel and I, or some of you and I, but I don't think Alaskans have found a unity yet on this proposal. And when we faced, finally, the pipeline issue, we faced one amendment. We got it down to the point, and we literally worked for months on that, but we got down to the point where we had one amendment, which was the key. When we faced the native land claims, I think we had about 10 things that we wanted covered, but we all were in agreement on them. We all got together in my office at that time, Senator Gravel and Governor Egan, Congressman Begich and I, and we worked out a list, and that was the list of things that we felt had to be involved, and people that came down and talked about that bill basically agreed. On statehood, we basically agreed what the tactics were. But right now, I don't think we're speaking with one voice. And I think in order to win this war, we've got to recognize that you cannot have everything you want, or I can't have everything I want in a D-2 bill. We've got to get an Alaska position and try to hang to it and try to get the bills in the House and the Senate to come as close to that as possible through legitimate lobbying techniques. But right now, I think if you asked people in the Senate in particular, they would tell you that they're not sure what Alaska wants, and that's why many of them haven't made up their mind whether they're going to go with the bill that they're being lobbied very hard right now on, or whether they're going to stay with us, because they know we don't have one position yet.
Representative Cotton.
The Western Coalition is a very interesting group, but was formed, as a matter of fact, by Senator Laxalt after he came up here. He was up here with me, along with Senator Hayakawa. I think Senator Bellman, who's also a Western senator, I think we can expect a great deal of support on a bipartisan basis from the Western Coalition. Because whatever happens up here in terms of this bill is going to seep down into the South 48, particularly the 17 western states. We have half of the remaining public lands of the United States in this state. The other half are down there in those 17 western states that are represented by that coalition. And if we're going to start new concepts, and this bill, this D-2 bill, does involve enormous new concepts in terms of land requirements to protect geographic features. The whole concept of the approach to ecology in these bills will require a reevaluation of all the parks of the West, and I think they see that. Incidentally, not that that's too bad. I don't think that's too bad to reevaluate them and determine whether they're fully protected, but to have the same principles applied out there would be disastrous. And I really believe that we'll get good support from the 17 western states, the 18 western states, and ourselves.
Representative Nackack.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Stevens, with reference to what you alluded to as the well-financed extreme environmental lobby and the recent snowstorms across the country and the poor folks down there on the East Coast, the Midwest, all over the country who are running out of energy resources. Is there any way we can capitalize on the fact that these folks are running out and we have, and the fact that we're not doing this with the intent of raping the land, we're going to be around here for centuries to come, that we do need their help to get at these things so that they can keep warm? Thank you.
Al, I think that all of this, and I think you've heard me say before that time is on our side as far as the D-2 issue is concerned. All of this is making people think a great deal more. I'll not mention his name, but there's one member of the Senate who was up here last year who at the time I thought was for the D-2 legislation as it was proposed by Congressman Udall and Cyberman. He's come to me within the last week and told me that he believes that we've got to take a good long look at this bill because of its impact, particularly in this area of energy resources. And I do think that's going to come across. But there, again, you want to look at the assets and liabilities. The liability side of it right now is Alaskan oil is a curse on the West Coast. I mean, it's in surplus, and we're fighting to find a way to get it to the over the mountains. We can't get the approval of California for the Sohio project. We can't get the approval of Washington for the northern tier or the so-called yo-yo line. We can't get approval of the Canadians for the Kitimat proposal. And we're going through the Panama Canal at high cost to us, and having a transshipment take place from the large tankers to smaller tankers down there off Panama, you know. It's just a matter of time until one of those things, something goes wrong on that transshipment, and that'll be another black eye for us. And to a great extent, it involves that attitude I tried to say in my statement is developing. There's animosity down there towards us. They blame us that our oil is not in the right place. They blame us that our gas is not already there. And to a great extent, I think they forget the reasons why it's not. Our gas would have been to the South 48 by now if our pipeline had been completed on time. I stood on the dock there in Valdez in 1969. I think some of you were there and watched the first shipment of that Japanese pipe come in. We tried to hold up the pipe, as a matter of fact, so we could get a rolling mill built in the Matanuska Valley, but we were told by the industry that had to go forward. We had no time, and that they didn't know it, neither did we. We had a lot of time, but had that pipeline been built and completed by 1972, and the gas pipeline followed on that, it would be finished. At least to be completed this year. I think these delays somehow or other, when you come down to talk to members of Congress, that's one of the things they're going to ask you, by the way. You know, why is it taking you so long? We need your resources. Why don't you develop it? And I think you ought to think about that and how you will, in some of the questions you'll be asked when you come down, because they're sort of tough. We haven't held back our resources that I know of. We have cooperated in every manner possible to make our resources available to the South 48 on a fair basis. And yet today, I think if you travel through the South 48 or talk to the members of Congress, you'll find they feel that somehow we're holding back. Somehow we want a little bit more for it. Somehow or other, they associate us, as I said, with the Arabs. And it's a tough problem for you to talk to those people, believe me. Some of you have already done it, I know.
Representative Kelly.
Senator, change the subject for a moment. On the Panama Canal, it's terribly important to both the nation and the state of Alaska. Are we going to be able to get a decent Panama Canal treaty that we could live with out of the Senate?
Well, I don't know. I'm still listed as an opponent of the Panama Canal treaties. And yet, as I've tried to explain, there's some things that have happened since I first saw the treaties. I don't like the treaties. As a matter of fact, my staff and I found, just in going through them, a substantial defect in the treaties. We've introduced an amendment to correct it. But I think that in and of itself shows that these treaties were hastily arrived at in their final conclusion. But I went to Panama, as I said. Many of us now from the Senate have gone there. And there are some of us that are against them, but we're willing to be convinced. If the Senate is willing to make the changes that are necessary, I think, to make the treaties more acceptable to the American people. The difficulty really is for a member of the Senate today is to get this in focus because of some of the approaches, legitimate, I think, approaches that are made to us. I have literally thousands of petitions from Alaskans opposed to the treaty. At the same time, I've had two visits now from President Ford, and the other day, I think he announced that I was down there, but I haven't made any statement about it until today. President Carter asked me to come down and visit with him on a personal one-to-one basis with no one else there. And the interesting thing was is both former President and President Carter were talking about the same thing. They were not talking about the Panama Canal treaties. They were talking about the presidency of the United States and how it's viewed in the world. If the product of the negotiations of four administrations, which have had the approval of four presidents, is rejected by the Senate. And they've talked to me about the role of the presidency in terms of world peace today and what it means to have the President of the United States be able to go to foreign countries as he must today in this type of world that we live in now and speak for the citizens of the United States. And they've asked me, all the president really asked me was to reconsider my position and to see if there was any way that the treaties could be made acceptable from my point of view, which, as I said, we're doing. But whether or not we'll get a treaty that will be acceptable, I think, depends to a great extent upon the American public. We're going to take a long time. I think this will be the longest debate since the civil rights debates, and you're going to get tired of reading about it and probably get tired of hearing about it on radio and television. But it's being done for a purpose, and it's being done for the purpose of trying to get across the message that we're hearing from the presidents, from former officials such as Secretary Kissinger, current officials such as Secretary Vance, the chiefs of staff. They all say the same thing, that the Panama Canal treaties in and of themselves are a mere symbol of the overall problem, and that's the problem of whether the presidency of the United States still has the really the effective voice and the role that it must have, immaterial who is president, in terms of being able to bring about world peace. Now, Tim, that affects me. I don't know whether, I think it would affect each one of you. I tell you, I'm still enough of a country boy that if I have the opportunity to sit in the Oval Room with the President of the United States alone, I'm impressed. You know, and I don't mind telling you I'm impressed. And it hit me very, very deep that a Democratic president would call me, a Republican assistant minority leader, come down and talk to him personally, not about the Panama Canal treaties, but about the presidency of the United States. Now, I don't know whether we'll get a treaty that, a series of treaties that I can finally vote for, but I earnestly hope I can. I couldn't right now. And I'll tell you that, I could not right now. I think the American public has to be accorded some role in those treaties. And there has to be some changes made to show that we've heard the objections that have been raised, and we've tried to change them to be responsive. But on the other hand, I do also think that in the course of the debate, you're going to get the flavor of what I'm trying to tell you, and that is that we are no longer just looking at two treaties and the agreements and attachments and minutes and whatnot that go along with them about Panama. We're now looking totally at the prestige of the United States from the point of view of the current president and the past president. Now, I know that that's not going to please a lot of you. I'll probably see a resolution from all of you telling me to vote against the treaty, which is your privilege. But I hope you understand what we're talking about, those of us who are still on the fence. And I would say that I'm against them and leaning towards the middle, if someone really wanted to know right now, Tim. And I earnestly hope that I can find the way to vote for the treaties in the final analysis. I wouldn't write today.
Representative Miles.
President. Senator Stevens, last year, President Carter at least temporarily vetoed the export of crude. In the interim, since he took that action, it seems like every economist and every consultant we've talked to goes on to explain the tremendous buying of a surplus of crude on the West Coast. And each new consultant who comes in seems to say it's going to go longer and longer, and the quantities are going to go up and up to the mid-80s. Is there any chance or any feeling that the president might be able to change his mind and allow us to export that crude?
Well, I haven't seen any indication yet the president might. I did have a conversation once with Secretary Schlesinger about that decision and urged him to reconsider it. Everything that we put together, and we have now available my office every year of one who's a person who's a fellow from Stanford, and the person who's been with me now for a couple of years has worked on this problem, and he came up using the resources that are available to these people, which are computer resources and of not only the Stanford but of industry, came up with a conclusion that both Japan and the United States could save as much as $100 million a year, and we could reduce tank traffic on the oceans by about 20%. If we exported our oil to Japan and we took the oil that they're currently getting and put it into the East Coast of the United States or the Gulf Coast. Now, as a community that's vitally concerned with the oceans, I think We ought to be interested in the potential reduction of the risk of pollution, and we ought to be interested in that savings to the government of, I mean, the taxpayers or the users of $100 million plus to each nation. The decision was made on the basis of a feeling that if we made such an arrangement at the time of an embargo, we would not have the facilities, really the total logistical infrastructure to deal with the distribution of our oil to the rest of the 48 states. He said it would take the pressure off California to approve Ohio, it would take the pressure off of Washington State to find a way to approve Northern Tier, it would take the pressure off Canada to approve Kitimat, and that therefore they were going to announce the policy, no exports would be approved. Well, once Pump Station 8's working again, which I understand will be when, about the first of next month, the production is going to increase and the surplus in the West Coast is going to increase and the problems and pressures are going to increase. And I think that it would be helpful if you would join us and ask the administration to review that decision. Because as long as we use American bottoms, as we've fought hard for the proposition that only American bottoms should come into Alaskan waters to get our oil, because that way we have the control over the crew, over the navigational system, and we have some control over construction. And I believe ultimately we'll have total control over construction. But I think it would be an interesting thing to see them renew that, reconsider that decision on the export of the oil. We really weren't going to export it, you know, we're just going to be a swap. They never could get it through their head. Just wanted to swap it. And they accused me every time we got it on the floor of trying to sell our oil to Japan, which we never wanted to do.
Representative Chatterton.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Senator. Senator, your comments were very heartening about your belief that there's still a solidity on the E2 issue. Yet I read that the Assistant Secretary of the Interior spoke before the Senate to your comments. I am told that
well, I brought to Jack Ferguson when I flew into the Post Intelligencer article about the defense of the administration's bill. And again, let me say it's not political because the last administration, you know, had a bill, and this one's got a bill. It's the executive. Let's put it the executive's bill on this subject. But the interesting thing was is that my good friend Guy Martin charged that, it says here, Martin in turn charged that Ferguson's boss, Stevens, had fictionalized rumors of internal strife in the Interior Department over the Alaska bill. And I'm sorry to see Guy involved in this. Before his appointment was confirmed, we had a little talk about it, and I thought he was going to stay out of it. And I'm serious. I'm going to go back and have a talk with him, where he's a friend of a lot of you, and he's my personal friend. He was actually on my staff once, as a matter of fact. Most people don't know that, probably. But I'm a little disturbed about this, because when he speaks today, he speaks as a former commissioner of natural resources of the state of Alaska. And when he speaks to the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, or in Spokane, or in Idaho, where he is today, he's introduced as a former commissioner of natural resources of the state of Alaska, but he's defending the executive department's bill that we oppose. And the bill I introduced, he helped draw. Now, fair is fair, and I think Secretary of Interior and Mr. Martin and I are going to have a little talk about that. Because I don't think that's fair. And I suggest we'll have a little talk about it at the Appropriations Committee hearing when they come before me.
Representative Akers.
Yes, thank you. Senator Stevens, this might be a bit of a broad question, but could you tell us just where the subsistence issue now stands in reference to D2? Has there been any major breakthroughs or any changes or anything of that nature?
I think, and I'd leave it for those who've been back there along with your steering council to judge too, but I think the result of the compromise that Don Young has worked out in the House is an improvement in terms of subsistence provisions in the House bill. I don't like that. It's got a kicker on it. You know, it says that subsistence is left to the state, but if somehow or other the feds don't like the way the subsistence is handled, then they can take it over within the federal areas. And I think we've got to have as a bottom line of our D2 approach, this is one of the things we ought to go over. We ought to have a meeting. I'm glad you asked that, because before you all come down, I hope we have a meeting, a strategy meeting, go over these things issue by issue on why we are where we're at. But one of the things we're objecting to is any invasion of our state's fish and game prerogatives. At the time of statehood, you remember we had a provision in there, the Secretary of Interior had to certify that we were capable of managing our own fish and wildlife resources before we could do that as a state. And we got Fred Seaton to do that almost immediately, and we've had our control since then. This subsistence provision deals with the question of the right of the state as a state to manage its fish and wildlife resources in terms of the taking. Congress has worked out for years a balance between federal lands and the taking of resources, and it says that the executive branch, the department involved, has the right to manage the habitat, but if any game or fish is to be taken off of federal lands, it must be in accordance with state law. Now, the bill that I've introduced, that we worked out, I think takes care of the subsistence provision by going in the direction, I think the governor mentioned it to you the other day, the increased powers of the regional fish and game boards. Because my bill says that if there is a restriction on the taking of any species, then the people who live in that geographical area must be given a priority in terms of the harvesting of the resource that is harvested under state law. That means, in the final analysis, the subsistence taking is the protected taking as far as taking fish or game. I think that bill is an improvement over what Congressman Seiberling had before. It hasn't gone far enough yet, though, and I believe by the time the Senate gets through with that provision, the Senate will not yield on the compromise that we worked out between the federal management and state, the impact of state fish and game laws and taking of fish and game.
Senator Bradley.
Senator Stevens, one of the most important provisions of the two treaties concerning the Panama Canal is the actual turning over of ownership and control to the Panamanians. I think this is to the Panamanians as well as to the United States citizens. And since we are the only power in the free world that can defend the free world, may I ask you specifically, do you think of this particular provision that we should give the Panamanians control and ownership of the Panama Canal by year 2000?
Well, Brad, you know, I'd be happier if we could. We're working on some amendments to see if we can turn this from a total takeover by Panama into a partnership concept. I don't know whether we can, but that's the direction I would like to go. As far as the canal itself is concerned and the control, you won't like this, but I'm going to tell it to you anyway. I told the Rotary Club at noon, you know, I was in China at the end of World War II, and I saw the effects of colonialism on China. After the war was over and we went into Peking and we went into Shanghai, I actually was in a house in Peking. It looked identical to the house I was in Panama not 2 months ago, and the house in Panama belonged to the commanding general of the U.S. forces in Panama. Big white structure full of all kinds of servants, the old fans up there beating away, and, you know, it was just colonialism at its best. Now, this country has no business being a colonial power. We are not a colonial power. I think we're dedicated to prevent
the growth of colonialism. And yet today, that's the impression I had when I was in Panama, that that was the last vestige of the United States as a colonial power. Now, I don't know what it's going to take to meet the needs of the American people to get their support for the objectives of these presidents to work out a new relationship with Panama, and that's what we're going to try to work on. But there's one thing I would, you know, I've got to tell you, and that is the ownership of that canal per se is to me not important, because I saw down there an attitude that reminded me of the attitude of some of the people who used to come up here in territorial days, and some of you here remember those people that came up for 2 years, had no interest in the future, they had no concern for the past, they were here to get a promotion or to carry out some function, and they really had no desire to be involved in the future of Alaska. I saw that. That's colonialism, sending people down to represent a foreign government that's in control. Now, any Alaskan that went down there today, and I met with some Alaskans down there, they cannot come away with a feeling that that's the thing the United States ought to be involved in. We ought to be able to work out a partnership whereby we can maintain our rights, and we do have rights in that canal, and it's very strategic to our national security, if not our defense. But as far as the colonialism, as far as the ownership of that land, I just don't believe that we ought to be involved in that. I don't believe the American people want us owning land throughout the country, throughout the world. We don't own Guantanamo Bay, for instance, and we're still there. We lease it. We don't own these bases we've got throughout the world where we're carrying on our NATO defense activities. And there's no reason why we have to argue over ownership of that canal. The question is whether we have any control over it, whether we have any rights to it, and whether we can protect it, and whether it will meet our needs. But the ownership of it, that's colonialism. And I really, Brad, I can't stay with you on that issue. It's not the issue of these treaties as far as I'm concerned. National security is, our economic security is, our right to defend that canal, our right to priority of passage. I question seriously the payments that are required by the canal to the Panama Canal, to the Panama people. Not the payments that come from the revenues, but the payments that are required to come from our treasury. But I don't question the decision to turn the control back over the Panamanian people. And I got to tell you, it strikes me pretty deep. I think we'd feel that way right now, you know. I felt that way, Brad, this last week. We were down, just sort of an aside, Mike and I were down meeting with the Canadians in New Orleans at a Canadian parliamentary conference, and one of the people had a good suggestion for a Kitimat. And those, Ernie, I want you to be seated now. Stay seated, Ernie Hogan. Because one of them brought me a map, and I brought it. I'm going to give it to Ernie because he had a good suggestion from a Canadian point of view. He said, we don't want you coming in to Kitimat with your oil. He said, look, all you need to do is come down to Wrangell Narrows and go into Wrangell and go up this river there, and we'll let you enter Canada and go across Canada if you dock the oil at Wrangell. I said, I got a fellow that I know that represents that area. I'm going to take that map to him and give him your name. Because, I know what the answer is. How'd you like to try to get tankers, large tankers, through the Wrangell Narrows? But seriously, we would object very much to using our country for a passage for a foreign purpose. Now, wouldn't we? Wouldn't you object if we turned the Alaska Railroad over to Canada? What if we gave the Alaska Railroad right away to Canada so they'd have an access into their Northwest Territories? Don't you think our people would get a little mad at it after a while of having to have a pass to go across that railroad right away? Well, you ought to see how mad those people get down there when they have to have a pass to go through the Panama Canal Zone from one side of their country to the other. And as American, I believe they're right. I believe they're right about that. They're wrong about the terms of the treaties, but they're right about wanting to have control over their own land and their own future as far as the land is concerned.
Representative Hogan.
Ernie, since the time that we had the first go-round between the State Department and our good friend Senator Magnuson and myself, I think the State Department has responded very well. I believe you'll find that I'm told that Elmer Rasmussen has congratulated Ambassador Negroponte, who is the negotiator now, for his activities in negotiating with the Japanese and with the Canadians. I think you'll soon see, hopefully by March, an entirely new arrangement that will give us control beyond the 200 mile over a substantial portion of the area that the Japanese previously harvested Alaska salmon in. And I've got to tell you, I think that's one of the great improvements that the new administration has made in this area is the attitude of the State Department towards fisheries negotiations. They're doing a better job. We're better served by what's going on. And I think the 200-mile limit is working. I hope the rest of you believe that. I went out and rode the Confidence for a couple of days and were with them when they boarded the Japanese trawler in the Gulf of Alaska just to see how they handled the routine and how the Russians reacted. I think the 200-mile limit is accepted. And just let me tell you, one of the great things that happened is this appointment of Jack Hayes as commandant. You know, we've got a former commander of the Alaska Air Command down in Colorado Springs, and now we're going to have Jack Hayes as commander of the commandant. If we could only find a new Secretary of Defense, maybe Alaskans could set the defense and enforcement policies for the country. I'm serious. It's a great thing to have him become the commandant of the Coast Guard, because he's been with us all the way through in the decision to expand Sitka and the decision to expand the Kodiak, take over the old Kodiak Naval Station, and the decision to put the helicopters in and keep the commitment they made to me about the helicopters based in Cordova. And I'm sure you know we have money in the budget being spent this year for shelter for the helicopters to be stationed to Cordova. We now will have complete surveillance of our coastline by the Coast Guard, and we'll all live long enough to see probably a majority of the Coast Guard assets of the United States committed to protection of Alaska's resources. And I think that having Jack Hayes there at this time is a great, great thing. I hope you all congratulate him. It's a crowning thing for his career, but it's really good for Alaska to have him go in there. But the 200-mile limit, in my opinion, is working, Ernie.
Representative Meekins.
Well, they don't own us anymore, Ross. I will say that. They just treat us like they do.
You mentioned in your speech the problem we have because of our PC, the image we have is Blue Eye Arabs, and as a member of the House Finance Committee, I see that we're currently being cut down from a lot of federal programs that are at the discretion of the people. And I think that I agree with your perception that we're about to have that even worse. And, you know, we're seen as having a lot of money, but I think downstream we might get some real trouble. And this morning, my question is that rather than spend a lot of money on some of the expensive projects that we have being proposed to us in this state, would it behoove us to realize that eventually we're going to get cut off like hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funds and try to take some of those over as soon as possible, as soon as our government allows to, and try to be more prudent in our expenditure proposals?
Yes, I think that's what I'm telling you. I'm reporting to you, really, rather than
I hope I'm not trying to tell you. I'm trying to report to you the way I see things. But I cut out some of the litany in my presentation of some of these things. But this, let me tell you some of the items that we've added. Just these are items just added to the appropriations bills in the last year. And there's a lot more. But just, we put $125,000 in the Cooperative Fishery Unit at the University of Alaska. We've got $1.2 million for transition for six Alaska schools to the BIA. $3 million for the housing improvement program for BIA, which included eight specifically earmarked for Vinitar. We had $600,000 for the design of a new barrel gas line. $600,000 for construction of fishways in the Forest Service area of Alaska. $250,000 for anadromous fish research for the Forest Service in Alaska. We put in $370,000 for the operation of the Nome Hospital. Now, that's a public hospital. I could go through these things, and we earmarked $1.3 million for LEAA to study the judicial system of Alaska at the request of the Alaska Judiciary. Now, that money's not going to be there much longer. And that's my report to you. I think we're going to try and keep trying, but as these people perceive us to be richer and richer, and we've got more and more income from our oil money and gas money, hopefully, that's going to stop. And you, that money comes in and you spend it. You know that. I'm not sure all the citizens of the state realize that, but we don't give it directly to these. It comes through the legislature if it's made available to the state agencies, and you appropriate. So I really think that you're going to have to take a look at the level of those federal expenditures and see just how far we may be getting in trouble. And I think that really the suggestion that I heard that not all of that renewable resource fund be committed is a good one, because I think it's the leaner years are ahead of us. I really do.
Senator Tillion.
Yeah, I've got two ones. First, just to touch on the Panama Canal. Is the canal on U.S. territory, or is it like Guantanamo Bay? I don't disagree with your position on that. Maybe it's just that it gets a little more technical when you actually start giving soil away like we did with the gas and purchase in 2006. And the other one is, yes, we appreciate Jack Hayes. He's been a marvel. They want to manage the fisheries in the 200-mile limit. And even when Negroponte has said, now don't blame us, we've told them that we're not going to complain about your quotas. Just don't spring them on us without not telling us. But Commerce actually wants a management authority. How do you think, will Magnuson stay with you on this complaint?
First things first. There is a lawsuit, by members of the House of Representatives who claim that because the canal is property of the United States in the full sense that the treaties cannot effectively be concluded without approval of the Congress. That issue has not been decided by the courts. I think that my comments go more towards the concept. Whether we own it or not, we treat it as though we own it, and we have treated it as though we've owned it for a long time. And when you have to have a pass to go through it, as Panamanian, I sort of think that tells me that whether we own it or not, it's ours as far as management is concerned today. And my point was, as former territorials, I'm not sure you would disagree with me about the reaction I felt when talking to the young Panamanians whose biggest complaint was that pass business of having to have a pass to go through a portion of their own country. As far as the last point is concerned, it's a very interesting thing. We're very fortunate, really. The young man that's going to take Howard Pollack's place in NOAA under the new administration is Bud Walsh, who traveled with me during the period of time we came up here and held meetings throughout the state on the 200-mile limit. He effectively, he was Senator Magnuson's right-hand man in writing that bill. He knows the background of it, and he is the one that's going to take the reins now in Commerce, and I think you're going to see a different attitude as far as carrying out the intent of Congress in the 200-mile bill. He knows Senator Magnuson's approach, and so far, and I hope it continues throughout our joint service in the Senate. I don't think Senator Magnuson and I have ever disagreed on a fisheries issue. As he stayed with us, you know, we wouldn't have had that Alaska Council, the only council in the country that, where we have the majority from one state. We would not have had the line drawn to where it was so we could have that happen if it hadn't been for Senator Magnuson. He's been a true friend of Alaska fishermen in dealing with fisheries issues and very fair. And Bud has been responsive to him and responsible to him for almost 10 years. So I think you'll see the Commerce attitude change. He was up at the last meeting of the Regional Council. I don't know if you were there. However, I would say that having dealt with the members of the Senate for 10 years, he ought to be pretty tough in bargaining in fisheries matters, and he's not going to be easily convinced that what we want to do is the right thing. You're going to have to convince him. But he's a very fair-minded guy, very talented young lawyer, and I think we're very fortunate to have him there. So I think that's going to straighten out.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. President. At the request of your office, Senator, from time to time, I've escorted some of your fellow senators around Alaska, and I found that although the people of Alaska don't have a position of unity on D2, that the country kind of speaks for itself. So I was intrigued by your comment in your talk about the best investment the state can make is sponsoring congressional fact-finding trips to Alaska. And I was doing a little figuring here, and if it costs us $30,000 to pack up as this legislature and go to Washington, it would cost about $350,000 to pack up Washington, your 535 colleagues, and fly them up here for, say, the weekend after the Cherry Blossom Festival, and take them around to see Alaska. I discard the idea because that sort of makes us look like Arabs of the North, but I wonder what you do have in mind by your statement.
Well, don't discard the idea. That's exactly what I have in mind. Instantly, Mr. President, my good friend back there in the back row is telling me I'm talking too long. I do hope that you'll cut me off when I should be cut off, and I hope that he will stop giving me the business from back there, because I can't help smile a little bit. But let me further answer Mr. Carpenter, if I may. I feel that the trip we brought up the Appropriations Committee, some of you saw them. We went to the North Slope, we went to Valdez, we came down the railroad, we went into Seward and looked at Seward's problems, and I'd be glad to document for anyone the things that directly flowed out of that visit. You know, God rest his soul, John McClellan, who just passed away, was the chairman. He was a good personal friend. He traveled with us. He saw the problems. He talked to the people, as did Hiram Fong from Hawaii, who's now retired. But before they left, one by retirement, the other one to pass on, they had done a considerable number of things for us because they knew us and because they knew the problems. And I'd be willing to bet that one trip that was done at federal expense brought, I'd say, upwards of $20 million, and I'll document that for you if you challenge me, to Alaska to meet specific problems that they learned about. Now, if these people come up here, one of the side effects, Russ, is going to be they're going to see these problems. Sure, we have the highest per capita income, but we have the highest cost of living. Sure, we have great projects coming. We still have real poverty in this state. And they should see both. I try my best. When Sam Hayakawa came here, he went fishing with us, and he saw the claims over there near Ketchikan, the borax claims. But we also saw to it that he went to Kotzebue, and he saw some of the conditions up there where people need help. And when Henry Bellman came here, he went up to see the North Slope.
But he also stopped off at Fort Yukon, and he saw the potential of the Yukon Flats, and is now dedicated to helping me get some experimental money for agriculture in the Yukon Flats. Now, I think, I don't care if it costs you $1 million. You'll get the money back 20-fold, but what's more, they will understand us. And we get allowances, just so you know, we get allowances to go to our state. Mike's and mine are the highest of any members of the Senate because of the cost of coming home. But a senator from Maryland or a senator from Kentucky, his allowances wouldn't buy him one round trip to Alaska. He can't come here of his own accord. He has to come here as a member of a committee, and there are probably only two committees that are involved in this bill. Now, and the other members of the Senate won't have any access to funds at all. I hope you'll seriously consider inviting them to come as our guest and working with the business community, again, the labor community, just as I want you to come there, I want you to do everything you can to entice them to come here. And I don't know how many will come. I still don't know how Don did it. You know, Don had over 50 members of the House here last year. Now, we're trying like mad to get some people to plan right now to come up here during one of the recesses. They'll only come during one of the recesses. There's only three periods of the year that they can come. I can tell you that right now. That's when we're out of session. And they'll come at Labor Day recess, the 4th of July recess, and the August recess. One of the three in the August recess will probably be too late. So we're only talking about probably 10 days targeted that we could deal with. Easter would be too early. We could do it for Easter, but it'd be much too early, I think, to get people to come up here then. And I'm not sure. I think they ought to be able to get into the areas and tromp around a little bit. I don't think they could too in some areas. But I'm serious. I think by what I said, I think you ought to consider getting these people up here some way and helping us.
Representative Parr.
That's a good question, you know, because we've got the bill's in full committee now in the House, and it's going to be marked up in the full House Interior Committee starting February 22nd. I anticipate it'll be out of that committee by sometime the first week of March. It then goes to Dingell's subcommittee in the House Merchant Marine Fisheries Committee that deals with wildlife refuges, and we had a meeting, John Ferguson and I had a meeting with and Steve Silver with the Representative Dingell. I think he's going to take a long look at this bill from the point of view of, again, some of the things that are being proposed to change about the traditions in national wildlife refuges. But I would say he'll have that bill in the House for a month anyway. Then it's got to go through the Rules Committee to get a rule to go to the floor. So if I'm correct, it can't get to the floor of the House before about the middle of April, 1st of May at the earliest. And that means that then comes over our way. And we're still involved, Senator Jackson is, in terms of the energy legislation and the land use planning bills. His committee, in my opinion, is probably going to try and get that bill out of his committee by the end of July. Again, that's just my crystal ball. And that would mean that it will pass before the Senate, before the August recess, and go to conference. And that conference will be in September, just before the election recess that must start the first week of October. So the visits I'm talking about for you to come to Washington, I think are going to occur sometime in late April, 1st of May for the House, and sometime in July for the Senate. And I'm sincere when I tell you, I think each and every one of you can be of great assistance to us by selecting the right people and getting to know those people and trying to impart to them the feelings of Alaska about the bill. Don't misunderstand, someone said, you know, to me that I shouldn't do this because we're down there to do this job and it's going to imply that we're not doing our job. If that's the implication, well then, you know, it'll have to be handled from
from in another forum the answer to that one. Because I think that the subject is so immense that we cannot handle the personal conversations that must take place with every member of that House and every member of the Senate. And while they know us and deal with us every day, the problem is to convince them that the Alaskan people really believe what we believe, because there are a number of people, including those who put that ad in the paper, who say we don't speak for Alaskans on this issue. That's the main problem. And I'll close this, Mr. President and Mr. Speaker, if you don't mind. That's the main problem we have, is that in dealing with the Congress today, there are so many people going down there that say, you know, this is how Alaskans feel. The environmental groups, I don't care who it is, when we've got an issue, this is how we feel. Well, I believe from everything I've been able to gather so far that with the exception, my good friend, of the Panama Canal, with the exception of the Panama Canal, there's been general acceptance of the people of Alaska of what we jointly have tried to do on the D2 issue and upon the issues such as the gas pipeline and oil pricing and a lot of other things that we're dealing with now jointly. I have not had any really hate mail about the gas pipeline, about oil pricing, about anything, but in the D2 area, there's probably 20% of our people that don't agree with us. And they're down there saying that they represent Alaska, and they're speaking with great money behind them. Now, I'm sincere when I tell you we need your help, and I hope when we work this out, if it's a partisan thing, I hope you'll get off it. And now I really am being serious to you as a former member of the House and a partisan person in the fullest sense of the word on most issues where partisan politics has a role. There's no role for partisan politics in the D2 issue. And I would hope that you'd recognize that and recognize that it is so much of an overwhelming issue for Alaskans for the future that we can't afford politics on. Maybe there'll be politics down the stream when one of you, and I thought maybe one of you might ask me a little bit about politics, one of you might decide to take me on, or someone will take me on. Maybe out there in the political arena, the way we've handled it could be a political issue. I don't deny that. But as we deal with the Congress, it cannot be a partisan matter. You've got to be able to go in as Democrats or Republicans to speak to Democrats or Republicans down there without regard to their politics and help us convince them that we know what we're doing and that 20% is not the 80%. Maybe there's some of you here that represent the 20%. I don't know. But you'll have to decide that for yourselves in your own conscience, whether you really represent the Alaskan people if you come down there. Because if you come down there, you've got to help us. And we really do need help. I've overstayed my leave. I want you to know, of all the things I've told my staff, of all the things that we spend more time getting ready for is your questions. It's a good experience to be up here. And it's a good experience to see you and to be able to exchange viewpoints. I think probably some of you get tired of us once in a while. In terms of our presentations to you. It's probably because we're just as wrapped up in our issues as you are when you come back to see me and tell me about the issues that you're working with. I've sincerely enjoyed, again, without regard to any partisan considerations, the treatment that I've received here every year in the 10 years I've come back. And I think that it's been helpful to the state to see and to hear an exchange between their elected representatives. I don't know if you disagree with me on Panama or some of these other things, but I just hope to God you agree with me on D2. I really do. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
joint session will come back to order. Is there any further business to come before the joint session? Senator Coletta? Is there any objection? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
House, please stand at ease. House, please come to order. Representative Miller.
Mr. Speaker, it'll be my intention in a brief moment to move for a 10-minute recess. But before we do, we have some distinguished guests in the galleries, and I believe in both galleries, that I would like to, if I may, introduce to the group. It's the Governor's Advisory Committee on the Aging, and I'm listing these in no particular order, alphabetizing or anything else, but it's a real pleasure for me to introduce these people, the leaders of our state. First of all, a former representative in this body, Mr. Al Widmark of Juneau. Carol DeYoung of Ketchikan. Another former colleague for all the members of this body, Bill Wiggins of Palmer. Former territorial governor Wayne O. Hendrickson of Anchorage. Catherine Fiala of Anchorage. The chairperson of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Aging, Mr. Zelmore Lawrence. Doris Southall of Fairbanks. Vera Siders of Fairbanks. Betty Warren of Kenai. Fletcher Gregg of Kotzebue. And with the group, in administrative capacity, Danny Plotnick, also a former representative in this body. Speaker, if there's nothing to come before the body before the recess, I'll ask unanimous consent we stand in recess for 10 minutes.
Hearing no objection, the House is in recess.